None of today's lecture is going to be on the exam, but I do want to continue the story of kinetics, and I'm going to do it carefully and somewhat slowly, only because you already have equilibrium you're worrying about, and I know until after the exam's over, no one's going to give a zarquan about the kinetics. So let me go back and start kinetics over again, you could say, after doing this big, huge theoretical presentation the other day of what kinetics is. Because when you read the text, it's going to go more like what I'm about to present to you. Give you the terminology, talk about a little bit of the math, and then build its way back up to the molecules. Since we already saw the molecular explanation, and we probably need to work with the math, that's why I'm going to go ahead and do this in the chapter order. Because we'll get the math out of the way, and that'll let us then link it back to the concepts that I smacked you all with on Monday. So let's start with what rate is, and no, I won't do the whole derivative thing again. That's just something I like to do. But more simplistically, rate in a chemical reaction is change in concentration over change in time. And of course, this is average rate we're talking about, and that's the only one we're going to talk extensively about, because you all have not had calculus as a class. See, when I took chemistry as a chemistry major, calculus was a prerequisite. So our chemistry class was a little bit different to start with. Now, there's this rate law thing. And I already explained why I did the whole conceptual thing first. It is because these concentrations are for the reagents that are participating in the rate-limiting step. At least that's for the simple type of reactions that we're talking about first. So, reagents that participate in the rate-limiting step. And, yes, rate constant, which I would like to talk more about. And what this discussion would be titled is the Arrhenius expression. Oops, expressions. I need to read up on this Arrhenius dude, because he was pretty busy. If he's got an acid-base definition and this kinetic thing is named after him, he did some chemistry. What is the Arrhenius expression? It says that the rate constant can be represented by this expression. Ooh, whoa, come back. Now, those of you who are not fond of math probably won't notice this. Those of you who are science majors, you might not notice this. But if you can remember this Clausius-Clapeyron equation that showed up in our lab discussion, that's what led to the graph that you had to do for experiment 2, you might remember me babbling at the time about these exponential expressions. And you see this e to the negative ea over rt. If you just change ea to heat of vaporization, now you have the Clausius-Clapeyron expression. This is also the same expression that, if I remember my math because I didn't practice it yet, the Van Hoff expression. These exponential factors are all about distribution of energy. In other words, the graph, the fact that molecules all have different energies. This is the same mathematical expression showing up again. So now what are all these things that are in this Arrhenius expression? So the most important of which, it's activation energy. R is the gas constant. T is temperature. A is for apple, and it's also for Arrhenius factor, or what I'm going to call the steric factor. And then we have the rate constant, which this is all equal to. So, activation and energy and temperature have an effect on a reaction, regardless of what kind of reaction it is. So suppose that everything else was equal in two reactions. We could talk about what would happen at different temperatures versus different activation energies. All right, so there's the mathematical way to do it, and then there's the graphical way to do it, which I mean, of course, the graph. And let's do the two temperatures thing first, because this whole discussion is going to sound familiar. So let's talk about, oh, let's just put all three on here. So we have low temperature. Medium temperature. And then high temperature. Oops, one moment. Low, medium, high. And of course, the axes, as usual, are energy per molecule or mole, and then number of molecules. Okay, so let's say that we have some activation energy. Well, this is just like the vapor pressure discussion. Oh, darn it, I did it again. I left someone in the waiting room. There we go. So at that same activation energy, the low temperature means not many molecules have the energy to get over that barrier. Higher temperature, more molecules, more with the energy. Higher temperature still, even more molecules have the energy. So as temperature increases, the number of molecules with enough energy to react also increases. Now, if I wanted to rewrite this expression, I could say that K is proportional to E to the negative 1 over T. Like, take all everything else out and just focus on T. K is directly proportional to the natural number raised to the negative 1 over T power. So that means that if temperature goes up, 1 over temperature goes down, but the negative 1 of 1 over temperature, that means it's going up. And so that means E to the 1 over temperature is going up, which is why K is going up. Which, that's just playing around with equations. That's not a fundamental chemical explanation. That's just looking at the equation. The graph explains what's going on. So that's why temperature matters for rate, because let's see, I said that the number of molecules with enough energy to react also increases, and so the point of it all is that rate increases. Take your screenshots, everyone. So now, let's see another version of the graph. Eh. But this time, I'm only going to take one temperature. But now let's say that we have three different activation energies. Now, what could that correspond to? What if you had a reaction that could make three different products? Well, let's make this an even easier case to understand. Let's say we have an endothermic reaction that we make possible by adding energy into it. Still, let's say we could make these three different products. You could see that to get to the lower energy product, we have a lower energy activation barrier, which I'm drawing backwards in colors. Hold on. There we go. So a higher energy product, higher energy transition state, therefore, higher energy of activation. So that's why I'm saying if you had an example where everything else is equal, but you had three different activation energies. Holy smokes, I'm sorry, I did it backwards again. I had it right the first time. Epic fail. You had one job. See, the activation, this is just me trying to show you how to correctly answer the question on the exam, right? Learn by mistake, totally. Educational, philosophical, yeah, I meant to do it. See, if you have the lower activation energy, that's why it's on the left, which means more molecules will have enough energy to react. Smaller staircase to climb. And then higher the activation energy goes, the fewer the molecules that you have that are able to overcome that activation barrier. Okay, so let me write that down before I manage to mess it up again. At the same temperature, all other factors being equal, the higher the activation energy, the fewer the number of molecules with enough energy to react. And that will mean a slower reaction. Now, this graph, let me label this. So this is a graph of one reagent making three different products. So that's why everything's being compared on one graph. You start at the same point, you end up with, term you may not know yet, isomers, molecules that have the same chemical formula but just happen to have different structure. So that could be exactly what's going on here. Now, mathematically, if we look at the Arrhenius expression, it turns out that K is directly proportional to E to the negative EA. So if activation energy goes up, negative activation energy goes down, K to the negative activation energy goes down. I'm sorry. E to the negative EA goes down. So the rate constant goes down, which again means slower reaction. Now, what's that other thing that's in the Arrhenius expression? This fudge factor, to use the phrase again. This steric factor. We'll come back to that. Because I've drifted into the end of the chapter again with all this discussion about activation energies and rates. But I wanted to talk about what this rate constant is. Because if you know that, oh, okay, that's why it's there. That's why a rate constant changes. It makes it easier, again, to talk a little bit about kinetics. So now let's return to some of the mathematical point. Unless anybody has any questions, let me check the chat window. I haven't done that in a little bit. No. Okay, so let me remind you of the two reaction examples that we talked about in the previous class. So, and let's talk about them one at a time. So remember, in this example reaction, we have an organic molecule that has a bromine on it, and that got attacked by hydroxide, the molecule it is, and the bromine gets kicked out, and we end up with methanol plus bromide. And you might recall that I made this big discussion about the transition state and how many molecules are participating at the same time. So let's just write that as a short reminder here. So in this reaction, both molecules participate at the same time. Now, you might recall that I said that the term bimolecular applies. But now let's talk a little bit about the math. But first, get your screenshots. So, remember that I had said for this reaction, the rate law would be this. And just to emphasize the theoretical point, since it's already been put out there, both reagents participate in the one reaction step. So both reagent concentrations affect reaction rate. Now, some mathematical terminology. you notice that there's an unwritten power of one in these reagents. So the expression that can be used mathematically is first order, which means a linear relationship between what? Concentration and rate. So when we say first order, that also you could mean as first power. So in the context of this reaction, we could say in this reaction, the rate is first order in bromomethane and first order in hydroxide. The reaction overall is second order. In other words, if we take 1 plus 1, it's going to equal 2 overall. So add the exponents, it's equal to 2. Now this is math. So to turn it into English, some kind of human speech, in this reaction, the rate limiting step is unimolecular in bromomethane and unimolecular in hydroxide. And the reaction overall is bimolecular. The whole point of all this discussion is to say that the term first order is the same thing as unimolecular. The term second order is the same thing as bimolecular. One set of terms. Maybe human's not even the right word there. It's because, Dr. Gray, that doesn't look very much like my English. Okay, so let's say chemistry. Because if we're talking about molecules, then the lower part is all about how many molecules are participating. And the technical terms are unimolecular, bimolecular, and it's more rare, but the term is termolecular. Let me put that off to the side, just because we don't say it much. So putting this in brackets to kind of isolate it a bit. 3 is termolecular. But in math, we have equations to describe it in terms of rate, and there we use powers in our expressions. And so we would say that it's first order or second order means the same thing, but one's about molecules, one's about math. So when you go to the chapter and read about order or molecularity, those are the terms that would go with it. Order and molecularity. What about another example, just to see how things would be different? Dr. Gray's going to try to come up with a kinetics experiment on his feet. Can he do it, folks? Sure. There must be some kind of kinetics we could study that it would involve two hydrogen atoms coming together to form the molecule H2, which the morning section would recognize as rather timely, since I spent a lot of time talking about hydrogen in lab today. So, what if, because this is the part I don't know without looking it up, that's why I'm flying by the seat of my pants here. So, what if this reaction occurs in only one step? Well, then we could write a rate law for it, just like we wrote for the previous reaction. And both of these hydrogens would be involved. So we'd have the concentration of rate constant times the concentration of hydrogen times the concentration of hydrogen. Which, if you rewrite that, it's hydrogen squared. Why is there a square in the concentration? Because each hydrogen separately has its own statistical probability of reacting, and so the concentration has its effect twice. But in any rate, it's multiplicative, so that ends up being a square. So again, this reaction is bimolecular, which means it's also second order, automatically. We only have one reagent. So in the previous example, I could talk about each reagent separately, like each reagent is first order unimolecular or second order bimolecular. Here, there's only one reagent involved. So reagent and reaction order or molecularity is exactly the same. Are we actually hearing any of this, or all that this is turning into is, when will he get back to equilibrium? The exam is equilibrium. When will the equilibrium come back?
Equilibrium.
Yeah, that's what I figured. That's what you're all really thinking, right?
Yeah, what's RLS?
Rate-limiting step.
Rate-limiting steps.
Yes. Or it's what's left when your Rolaids dissolve, if they still make Rolaids.
Oh, yeah, they do. The one with the caramel inside?
No. The thing that's an antacid that you take when you're like totally stressing over your exams or how you're going to teach your class.
Oh yeah, those are Rolos.
Those are Rolos. Yes, yeah. Which I probably wasted class time saying this, but it happened again just the other day that I had one of those stress dreams that in the middle of the dream I'm in a class and it's going, I mean, horribly, like. Nobody knows anything, and it's not the student's fault. It's because, like, I'm trapped in my office, and I'm trying to get to the lecture hall, but I'd, like, you know, the infinite hallway, the one, or you go through the door, and you're suddenly somewhere else, and where's the lecture, and I'm running late, and they're going to be mad at me. And it just never ends, folks, is what I'm saying. Anyways, shall we move on?
Is this Shexin 16.34?
Well, you know what? Why don't we actually start walking through the book? Because since I've bounced around through the entire chapter, and I do eventually end up going through the book anyways to help people out, let's just do that.
Yay!
I would do something silly like ask how many people prefer to just go section by section, and I'll see like the entire class light up at once. Let's do it. How many of you would prefer it if Dr. Gray would just go section by section?
If it's easier.
Well, you know, I
don't. You can go home and whatever you want, but. Like, just tell us at the beginning what section is it, so.
Okay, you know. Okay. Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I kind of expected everybody just light up. It could be that everybody just logged in and now they're on Fortnite, but. Okay. So, section one, it gets into what reaction rate is and talks about The rate is related to concentration. It gets that idea out really early, even if it doesn't do all the theory behind it. But it just says that molecules have to bump into each other in order for a reaction to happen. So more molecules bumping into each other, more reaction. Temperature. We already went through the larger explanation of temperature, but temperature has to do with energy. More energy in collisions, more reactions that are going to be able to occur. So section 16.1 gives you that overview. That's why if you even started the chapter and you read that first, that's why bits and pieces of this lecture make sense. But then you're like, it doesn't go that deep. Not that deep in that first section, because the first section's the overview. And then it gets to the math part, exactly like I always says it does, where 16.2 starts right off with definition of change of position, meaning speed. So it gives you delta X over delta T, and it talks about how in chemical reactions, we talk about delta concentration over delta T. And then it does get into average versus instantaneous rate. It does have a graph where it does kind of the same thing I do, where it does a tangent and talks about, but it doesn't go into the calculus, of course. But it does get into what average rate is. Now, one section we haven't covered yet is relating reactants and products together. To me, that's a more advanced concept because that means you have to understand the chemical reaction going on as well. So we're going to come back to that part of 16.2 later, how to relate reactants and products together. That's the very end of the section, though, so we have covered most of that. Now, 16.3 is what I've been chugging away at this morning, which is the rate law itself. And so it does then go into, like it says, here's the rate law. And it does define what order is. It says, here's a first-order reaction, a second-order reaction, and it actually gets to the point there's such a thing as a zero-order reaction, which I'll talk about later. And it talks about what would concentrations look like, and it does talk a little bit more about reaction order. But then it goes deep off the deep end into math, where it talks about, well, how could we use a set of concentrations and change those concentrations and measure the rates of reaction in order to come up with a rate law? That's the math part that we'll do later, because that's the part where people start, like, all the rest of it, the theory, even if you're not, like, wild about chemistry, it's more of a story, sort of like, okay, if I can just learn the story, I can manage the questions. And yes. And then there's this other math stuff that's a lot of section 16.3. So we have to come back to that. And then, is this the same section that does this other thing too? Let's see. No, that's another section. Okay. So most of 16.3 we have not done, because we have not done this method of initial rates. 16.4, we haven't talked about that at all. Because it's something called integrated rate laws, which is even more calculus in its heart than what I've talked about before. So then where we've been spending most of our time is 16.5, which is about collision theory, and that's where you get the Arrhenius expression. So, and then it goes into the importance of activation energy. It even does... Okay, this is easier. If you could just look at me, the me that's actually talking, not the screen share, and you can see here, there's, in your textbook, the graph. So even your textbook uses that exact same explanation to talk about differences of temperature and how that affects rate. And then, of course, I talked about how differences in activation energy would go affect rate. The one thing that we haven't talked about yet is the steric factor, because this section also goes into a deeper discussion of the transition state. Now, the really scary thing is, and this happened even before I ever read this particular textbook, but the transition state that it uses is bromomethane reacting with hydroxide, exactly the same reaction that I've been discussing in class. So it's very lucky for me that that's exactly the very extensively discussed reaction in your textbook. And it writes the reaction coordinate diagram just like we did in class. So that's why I've been spending so much time, because it's all right here in 16.5. Now, 16.5 is not a very long section, but it is the heart of kinetics. And from there, we then get to mechanism, the discussion of rate-limiting step and these terms of unimolecular, bimolecular, and termolecular. So it talks about what the importance of the rate-limiting step is, but then it goes deeper again. It goes into much more advanced kinetics, and which we will get to eventually, but slowly. And that, I think, is the last section of the text, right? Oh, no, there's the easy topic, which I'd love to talk about because we have just enough time, and that's about catalysts. So there was our walk through the textbook. So we've tackled like most of the chapter in terms of our sections, but just partway through each section, like because I'm trying to give you that big picture perspective. And we're slowly going to be working on the details like what we're doing today. So there. So let me talk about catalysts really quickly because I can talk about them really quickly. Now, some of you might have electric vehicles. I'm guessing statistically most of you, if you have a car, you've got a gas guzzler like I do still. And you know then that one of the pricey parts of your car is your exhaust because you have what's called your catalytic converter there, which is usually made of platinum or palladium or some other pricey metal as far as the working components, which is why there occasionally will be these rounds of where people get their tailpipes jacked, being stolen, because they're not stealing the tailpipes, they're stealing the catalytic converter to get the platinum or the palladium out of it. So that's just a real-life example. Of course, there's these things, enzymes, which are also catalysts. They're biological catalysts. So whichever way you want to think, there's something that changes the rate of a reaction. So I know I've been bouncing back and forth between reaction coordinate diagrams, reaction progress diagrams. We're now back in reaction coordinate diagram. So we're going to talk about one instance, one set of molecules reacting. And let's say that they have a single step to react normally. Now, what if we throw in some other substance that changes how the reaction occurs? And maybe in this other pathway, there are two steps instead of one. But you notice, and please let me change my example because I want to avoid a really painful discussion for the moment. We'll get to pain later. So you notice that in this other example reaction, it's got a lower activation energy than our original reaction. So what I'm going to call these are the uncatalyzed and the catalyzed reactions. Now, typically, U for uncatalyzed, there we go, and C for catalyzed. Normally, when you're taught about what catalysts are, you're taught that they're substances that speed up a reaction but don't get, they don't get consumed in the pace of the course of the reaction. Yeah, that's an ideal case that a catalyst never gets consumed. In real life, there may be some slow decay of a catalyst, but that bypasses the chemical point I'm trying to make. Because the other way that people often say what a catalyst is it's something that lowers the activation of the energy of the reaction. And that's not quite true either, because these are different reactions. They have different mechanisms. So, here is my formal definition of a catalyst. A catalyst is a substance that speeds up a reaction by creating a new reaction pathway that has a lower activation energy. So that's why I gave an example that had two transition states for the catalyzed reaction to highlight the fact that it's different from the uncatalyzed reaction. So it's a little bit imprecise to only say it lowers the activation energy of the reaction. Now there's another point that I want to make that's not directly related to the kinetics chapter, but you know we're just coming out of the equilibrium chapter, aren't we? So notice that both of these processes have the same overall heat of reaction. So a catalyst only changes how a reaction occurs. It does not change the reactants or products. Now, all along I've been saying that energy in the system depends on the concentration of reactants and products. So if you're not changing the reactants and products, you're not affecting an equilibrium. So the point is, a catalyst has no effect on an equilibrium constant.